Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoeffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. When earthquakes occur, they sometimes generate tsunamis that can pose great risks to coastal communities. The 2004 earthquake off Sumatra killed an estimated 228,000 people. The 2011 Fukushima earthquake east of Japan produced a wave more than 130 feet high, and while many survived by quickly moving to upper stories of taller buildings, death and destruction were widespread. In Tunglin, Washington, a coastal location that is at risk for tsunamis, an evacuation tower has been constructed by the Shoalwater Bay Indian Tribe, serving not only tribal members but the entire community. This tower can hold more than 400 people, and it's a model for vertical towers that may be constructed in other tsunami hazard zones. Here to tell us about this project is Maximilian Dixon, who's Earthquake Program Manager of the Washington Military Department's Emergency Management Division. He has 3 degrees from the University of Washington, a BS in Environmental Policy, and 2 master's degrees in Urban Planning and Infrastructure Planning and Management. Maximilian, I'm very happy to be talking with you today.
Thank you for having me.
So start with easy questions. Where is Tunglin, Washington?
So Tunglin, Washington is south of Westport. So it's on the very coast of Washington State, towards the southwest. It's in the upper portion of Pacific County.
If I looked correctly at the map, it's right on the water.
It is, yes. High risk for tsunami.
And what's the nature of the community? I mean, is it a residential area where people go off to work during the day? Is it busy and populated all the time?
So there's, my understanding is around 300 or so folks that live there. As for the outer coast, it is highly dependent upon recreation. So it's visiting, going fishing. So really that hospitality recreation industry. And so there's a lot of people that visit year round. Which means that there are a lot of folks that are out there that don't necessarily know that there's a tsunami risk, nor what to do when a tsunami is on the way.
Interesting. So that poses a rather different problem than if you were dealing with a residential population.
Yes, it does. Now, residential population, you know, there is a number of folks that do live on the outer coast. Ocean Shores probably has the highest number of folks that live in a single jurisdiction on the outer coast. But yeah, Tunglin, I think there's about 300 or so permanent residents.
And what is the Washington Military Department, and what is your role?
Yeah, so I'm actually the Hazards and Outreach Supervisor. So I manage the Geological Hazards Program, so earthquakes, tsunami, volcanoes, as well as the Individual and Community Preparedness Programs. So we do a ton of outreach to all of the folks in Washington State, as well as working with our media partners, all levels of government, and actually international partners. And it's all about risk reduction. So our big focus, of course, is risk reduction for earthquakes, tsunamis, and volcanoes, and to some extent landslides. But that equates to preparedness for any type of disaster. Because if you're getting prepared for an earthquake or a tsunami, then you're going to be able to understand what to do during a major disaster, what supplies you need, how to get prepared, how to get information, how to get alerted. And that's going to help you for most other emergencies or disasters that you might face. And our whole team there is really the whole cycle of emergency management and risk reduction. We want folks to be informed, to understand their hazards, know what to do to reduce their risk from those hazards, be able to get prepared. So when it does happen, because we live in earthquake country, we have the second highest earthquake risk in the United States, it will happen. So folks getting prepared for that, and then knowing what to do to respond during the event. So the drop, cover, and hold on, get to high ground, protect themselves, and then what to do immediately after, and then how to recover quickly. And so it's really working with not only the public, the media, but all stakeholders on how to work on reducing risk and saving lives.
So where did the initiative to build the Tunglin Tower come from?
Well, we had Professor Bob Freitag and my predecessor, John Schelling, working together on 2010. And then we had the, you're talking about tsunamis and the risk, because 2004 woke up a lot of people, as it should have. And so there was discussion on, well, what's the risk in Washington State? You know, well, what can be done? And then we had the Great East Japan earthquake and tsunami in 2011, and that really galvanized efforts. So they came together, got grad students, actually from my program, to work on safe havens using the examples that worked in Japan during the 2011 earthquake and tsunami. And so it was, how do we, you know, called the Safe Haven Project, how do we bring that to Washington State? And that's really where it started. And there were a series of community meetings around 2011 looking at, well, how many vertical evacuation structures would be needed? Where would they need to be placed? What would they look like? Towers, berms, you know, reinforcing buildings. What are the options? And that really kickstarted it here in Washington State. And then we had, of course, the first vertical evacuation structure built in North America, Okasta Elementary School. And that was funded through bonds, school bonds. So self-funded, because vertical evacuation structures were not yet eligible for federal funding, for FEMA funding. They are now, and our next vertical evacuation structure, our second one, third one built in North America, second one built in Washington State, was the Shoalwater Bay Tribe vertical evacuation structure. First Native American built structure, first standalone tower. So a lot of firsts going on, but we have, during this whole process, we created a vertical evacuation structure manual for communities. We just completed our second edition update earlier this fall. And we're working on assisting other communities, Ocean Shores, Westport, which got funding, Ocean Shores got funding, and Long Beach on building more vertical evacuation structures. Because in 2021, we completed a study on how many vertical evacuation structures we need here in Washington State. And we need at least 58 at a minimum to cover our residents and folks that will be working in the communities. So we know quite a bit of what we need, and we've done quite a bit of work. And we did hire, just in the last few months, we did hire a vertical evacuation structure project manager. So someone to focus solely on, how do we build all these vertical evacuation structures that we need in Washington State? How do we get them funded? How do we support our communities to do that? So we're really kickstarting this effort and continuing to move along, because it's going to take decades to build these.
That's a lot of accomplishment in a fairly short period of time. I'm very impressed by that. I just want to take you back to verify my knowledge. The school example that you gave, the first case, was that not a design where the safe haven was on the roof of the school?
Correct. Yeah, it was a school bond. It took them the third time to pass it, but they did. I think it was over 70% of the folks voted in favor of it. And what it is they built a new elementary school, and they put in like 50 or 55 foot deep pilings, reinforced it to be able to withstand the waves, and then built, reinforced the gym so that it could be high enough and that folks could access it, and it would act as the vertical evacuation structure.
So taking you back to the Shoalwater example, as you described it, it sounded like you brought the initiative to the community rather than the community asking for this protection. Is that an accurate description?
No, it was a combination. So over the years, you know, since Safe Haven started, Lee Shipman, I would call her Auntie Lee, amazing, amazing person. She is heavily involved in the tsunami work groups that we've been running for decades on tsunami risk reduction in Washington State. And so through this involvement and this coordination over the years, she realized, and we had discussed, and my predecessor had discussed, you know, what the risk is for the coast of Washington, which of course includes the Shoalwater Bay Indian tribe and their land, right? And their community members. And so through that effort and awareness, Lee Shipman decided that she wanted to take action. And so they had been working on this for a while to get the match funding that they needed, because when you apply for federal funds, say through a Building Resilient Infrastructure Communities grant, right, then you have to provide a local match. And what that means is then the community has to be able to get the funds or allocate the funds to that project. And these vertical digression structures cost millions of dollars. They're very expensive. And so they needed to get support from the community, and she needed to get those funds secured. Once she did that, then she called me up one afternoon, and you always answer the phone when Lee Shipman calls you. She's a force to be reckoned with, and she's wonderful. And of course, we always want to work with her. She's fantastic. And so she called me and she said, "Well, I'm ready to go. We want to build a vertical evacuation structure and we want to apply for funds." And I said, "Great, fantastic. I'm glad you called me. How can I help?" And she says, "Well, I need help in putting the application together and figuring out what the process is." And I said, "Great. So how long do we have?" She said, "5 weeks." So, and of course, you don't say no, right?
Why 5 weeks?
Because that was the application deadline.
Oh, I see.
Each grant application, of course, is annual, and there's a deadline. You have to apply by a certain time, or else you have to wait till the next year. And so we had 5 weeks together, but we work with all the subject matter experts that we needed. We have wonderful folks that want to save lives and are working hard and been working hard for many years to do this. And so I called up our partners. We got a game plan together and we made it happen. We got the application in. They were successfully awarded funding and the structure has been built. Now, we learned a lot of lessons along the way and we're still learning lessons. So it's been a helpful structure, not just in, of course, saving lives, over 300 people in the Tokeland area who are not tribal members. But also, folks that are visiting. And we learned a lot during the process, which, was great to help us to give context, update our manual on how to build these, which is going to help every other community, and also around the United States and the world. And we're still learning lessons on, maintenance requirements, signage, lighting, supplies. So in a lot of ways, Lee Shipman and the Shoalwater Bay Tribe have really paved the way and is not only helpful for, saving lives for the Tokeland area and surrounding community, but also in us better understanding how do we successfully build these, what do we need to do, and being able to instruct and further assist other communities in building similar structures.
What kind of support, what kind of justification did you need in the grant application to be successful?
So with any type of mitigation project, there are a few key elements that you need to have. So one is you need to have an approved hazard mitigation plan. So whether that be a school district or jurisdiction or a special purpose district or a tribe, you've got to have a FEMA-approved hazard mitigation plan and have the hazard identified and the mitigation, essentially the proposed mitigation project mentioned within this hazard mitigation plan. So it has to be part of your official planning, right? Then you need to have the modeling. So let's say for tsunami, vertical evacuation structure, you need to have tsunami modeling that's site-specific. It's okay, this is the location that you want to build this safe haven, and you need to have the latest tsunami modeling that's been peer-reviewed and showing how high could the waves possibly be? How strong could the water be as far as the force loads and the impact from the tsunami waves on the structure itself? So you've got to have that latest modeling to tell you how high you need to build it and then how strong you need to build it, right? So it can withstand the shaking and those waves. And then you need to do a preliminary design. So you said, okay, well, based on the height, then, there are FEMA requirements, so you have to have, has to be 30% higher plus an extra 10 feet to make sure, because modeling is modeling, right? It's imprecise. We don't know exactly what the next tsunami or series of tsunamis is going to be like, but we have to make sure that we're spending all this money and we're telling people to go to this life-saving structure that it's actually going to save their lives. So the modeling helps us for the height and how strong it needs to be, and then we add 30%, 10 feet. We need that preliminary design. How much is it going to cost, right? So the design of the structure, the placement of it, the materials, how much are they going to need to be able to build it? And then you need to do a benefit cost analysis. So it needs to be, it needs to save is either as much property or lives value as it is that you're, or more than you're putting in to to cost for doing the mitigation, right? So it has to be greater than one ratio. And in order to do that, then you have to demonstrate, well, who's at risk? What's at risk? And what are you mitigating? And what's the dollar value there? And so putting all of that together, of course, with all the details of, you know, the site and, you know, the match, you have to have a required local match. So, you know, essentially dedicating the funds and having community support. So there's a list of things that are essential to be able to put this application together. And, of course, there's a lot of details you have to fill out in the application itself. But that's the main element.
So who did the modeling?
For Shoalwater Bay Tribe?
Yep.
I believe it was Randy Levesque and Lois from the University of Washington.
So UW?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And who did the design?
For the design, I believe that was Degenkolb Engineering that did, at least handled kind of the facilitation of that. I don't know who all the subcontractors were. I can't remember off the top of my head.
What does the tower look like? What is the design?
Yeah, the tower. So it is, I believe the overall height is somewhere around 55 feet high. It is a metal tower. You have two staircases on either corner that spiral up. You have the security fencing around the base of the structure. It's on a cement pad. And you've got around 50-foot pilings that go down into the ground to secure because it's, of course, you know, sandbars all along the coast. Then you have two platforms. So the lower platform, which, again, is more than 30% higher than the expected wave, plus 10 feet for the highest wave. And you have, it's lined with storage for, that has, you know, ponchos and some basic supplies for folks. There are a backup battery system that lights up lights so you can see it. So, you know, tsunamis tend to happen in the middle of the night. And for a Cascadia subduction zone, the likelihood of having any type of lighting or power is going to be very low. So you're going to be in the dark. So having the tower lit up like a beacon of hope is essential. And so they have that. They also have a communication system there so they can, you know, communicate with, you know, whoever is able to has, you know, radio. And then you have a second deck, which also has supplies and protected containers for folks. And so you can, and then you have sort of wind screens to be able to block some of the wind. So it's this double-decker tower that has, again, two staircases, and it can hold over 400 people.
Are there provisions for protecting people who are mobility limited?
So when you say protecting, what do you mean?
Getting them up to at least the first level.
So that's a challenge. They're still working on what is the best method for that. It's, if you, just as an example, if you were to put in ramps, I believe that's an extra potentially 25 to 30% additional cost. Because of the additional concrete on the footings, all the added steel and materials. So it's a significant increase in the cost. And it has been a challenge with funding through FEMA in order to pay for those additional costs. Now that's improving. So I would say that's an area that we're collectively really working on is how do we afford and, you know, essentially make the best use of limited funds to build structures that can save the most number of folks, but at the same time, then accommodate for folks who have mobility issues. It's a big challenge, and I say that we haven't answered that fully yet. There are options. But that's still being explored.
And how is the decision made about precise location?
Precise location?
Yeah.
So there's a few factors. One, the property needs to be owned by the jurisdiction or entity that is applying for the funds, right? So let's say it's, you know, Shoalwater Bay Tribe. So they need to own the land or have an agreement to be able to use the land for that purpose. So that's your starting place. Then you want to look at, well, with the land that is owned and that's usable, is it big enough? And then what's the highest elevation, right? So the higher the elevation is, then the less material, the less, of course, you know, it doesn't have to be as built as high. So you're going to have cost savings. And so you want to be able to build it on, you know, it makes a difference. 10 foot elevation makes a big difference in cost. And so you want to choose the highest ground that you can, but also access, right? So, and proximity. So proximity to the most number of folks that are at risk, that will not be able to make it to high ground. And then the access to that particular piece of property where the tower or structure is going to be. So making sure you have really good access, because when, you know, after the 3 to 6 minutes of shaking, let's say it's the middle of the night and it's dark, you want to make sure that folks can easily get to the structure. You don't have things that are blocking it. And then having, you know, if you're hopefully we're planning out, because a lot of communities are going to need multiple vertical evacuation structures. So, you know, where would the next one go in proximity? And then, of course, selling the community on it. If there is an option, say, next to a school versus somewhere else, well, you might get more community support if it's next to the school as you're protecting your children. So there's a lot of factors to consider.
How much warning time do you assume?
Well, for a local source tsunami, say Cascadia Subduction Zone, the shaking is your warning. So, you know, I mean, we're expecting potentially 3 to 6 minutes of shaking, and then it depends on where you are along the coast, but it's about 10 to 15 minutes for that first wave to arrive across most of the outer coast. So 3 to 6 minutes of shaking, drop cover and hold on, get up as quickly as you can, as soon as you, if you feel like you can move safely to get to high ground, because you don't have a lot of time. I mean, 10 to 15 minutes, that's not a lot of time.
So it sort of affects, if you will, the service radius, that is, how far away are people going to be who are going to be served by this?
Yes, absolutely. And that's why, you know, with our study on how many of these need to be built and where, because we also provide recommendations on, you know, potential locations, we needed at least 58. And that does not include, you know, visitors. That does not include, you know, massive numbers of people out there visiting.
So okay, that's going to be a big group. And as you say, they're going to be naive relative to the residents about what the risks are. Do you assume people are going to walk, run, drive, all modes to get there?
Well, our messaging for our many, many years has been to not expect to be able to drive. If you look at the latest tsunami that we just had, if you look at California, there's prime examples there of traffic jams. So people trying to drive to high ground in California from the warning that we just had and last week. And so we tell folks, don't expect to be able to drive, because with very intense shaking on the outer coast, trees falling over, telephone poles, you know, potential rubble in the streets, everybody trying to get in their cars, potential accidents. The likelihood, you know, bridges being damaged, roadways, liquefaction, landslides, the likelihood that the very few routes that they have to get to high ground in many of these communities is going to be open and not blocked is a very low likelihood. So expect to move on foot and or if you have a bicycle or some sort of moped or something that might be viable, then utilize those methods to be able to move as quickly as possible inland and to as high a ground as possible.
So 58 is your target right now, and that's probably just the beginning, if I get it.
Yeah, it's going to take a long time, but we are gathering momentum.
Are you talking to those 58 communities?
So it's not 58 communities. The majority of these need to go into Grays Harbor County and Pacific County. So Ocean Shores, of course, you know, at least 23 there. Westport needs a number more. Long Beach needs a number. So you're really, you know, there's maybe a few locations in Clallam County, but you're looking at Grays Harbor County and Pacific County.
So the number really, it seems to me, is driven by the assumptions you make about the if I'm going to use the term radius of service, how far away people are going to be that need to get to these rescue points.
Yeah, number of folks there, how quickly they can get to the location, and, you know, of course, based on the modeling, right? So the wave height and the arrival time.
Yeah. Are you optimistic about achieving that goal?
Well, I mean, I've got to be optimistic, right? I mean,
yes.
This is my job, and these are the folks that we're working with, and we're talking about saving lives.
Interesting. Are you in contact with people outside the state of Washington, communities which likely would need similar kinds of protection?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we worked with Puerto Rico. We worked with California, Oregon, British Columbia, with New Zealand. We've worked with quite a few partners around the United States who are considering or working on vertical evacuation structures, and quite a few international partners, as well as, you know, having discussions in Japan on lessons learned.
Mm. So together, it sounds like you're participating and contributing to setting the standards, developing a model strategy for achieving this kind of protection.
That's what we're trying to do. So we have P646, which I reviewed. It was part of the third edition. So that's really getting into the specifics and sort of the engineering aspect and requirements for vertical evacuation structures, a FEMA document. And then we developed a manual for the communities, right? So what steps they need to take. And like I said, we just updated that with lessons learned. And we're happy to help, you know, provide any type of guidance or lessons learned and collaboration with, you know, with whoever we can, because we realize that, you know, in this field, there aren't a whole lot of us. And so we need to be able to work with each other, sort of maximize our efforts, learn from each other, so that we can do better with the little few resources and people that we have.
So this sounds to me like a particularly valuable use of your knowledge and your training in infrastructure planning and management. There's a finance side, there's a planning side, there's a modeling side, there's a community outreach and support building activity, a very multidisciplinary activity. So I'm pleased that we had the opportunity to talk with you about this. I wish you great success in achieving that 58-plus objective, and we'll try to keep an eye on what you're doing and continue to learn from you. So thank you very much for the conversation today.
I appreciate it. Stay safe.
All right. Good luck. Thank you. Bye. Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I'm Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.